He was a symbol of the Holocaust.
The methodical killer, the Nazi Holocaust monster.
He is directly culpable for the murder of 6 million Jews.
Mossad receives this information that Adolf Eichmann is living in Buenos Aires.
We were sure that this man was Eichmann.
The Mossad agents are running a terrible personal risk in going on this operation.
The order was very simple: to capture him, to bring him to Israel alive.
April 1960, Argentina. One of the world's most notorious Nazi war criminals, Adolf Eichmann, is living incognito with his family near Buenos Aires.
The family have in fact moved to a street on the outskirts of Buenos Aires called Garibaldi Street.
But a blind Jewish piano tuner whose daughter briefly dated Eichmann's son has tipped off Israel's secret service. Now, the man branded the architect of the final solution is in the Mossad's sights.
The information on the table was that he was in the Argentine on the name of Ricardo Clement, that he lives in San Fernando, a suburb of Buenos Aires, in an isolated house.
Why were we so skeptic? There was no electricity, no water, no nothing. We asked ourselves why a man like Eichmann goes to a dump like that.
The Mossad agents thought there's no way that Eichmann, you know, a lieutenant colonel in the SS, the murderer of 6 million of our people, lives in this very, very modest little bungalow. It's impossible.
We are sure that we got the wrong person. It's not Eichmann. It's the wrong man.
Mossad spy Zvi Aharoni is sent to Argentina to investigate. He enlists a local volunteer to help.
So Aharoni goes to rather extraordinary steps with one of his people going up to the house, speaking to him about trying to buy land in the adjoining district.
We had the camera hidden in a case so you can't see it.
You would press certain buttons on the handle and it would click these photographs.
You can make pictures, and the man doesn't know that you've been photographed. And that's how we got these pictures.
He gets the pictures, the man he thinks to be Eichmann, and he looks at it, compares it to old portraits of Eichmann.
The left ear is like a fingerprint. They photographed this man with his left ear. And we had a photograph of Eichmann in SS uniform with his left ear.
We were almost sure, I can't say 100%, that the man was Eichmann.
Aharoni returns to Israel and presents the evidence to Mossad chief Izer Harel. Harel takes it straight to the prime minister, David Ben-Gurion.
Ben-Gurion recognizes an opportunity, but he's fearful that the Israeli youth will forget what happened to the Jews and that the world will forget what happened.
Ben-Gurion instructed Israel to bring to Israel Adolf Eichmann for a trial in Israel.
The plan is simple but daring. A team of secret agents will kidnap the war criminal and smuggle him 9,000 miles to Jerusalem. Harel enlists the one man with the skills and the nerve to run such an operation, Mossad commander Rafi Atan.
I decided how many people I need, okay? And I started to choose the people.
Rafi Atan puts together this team that is kind of the standard of what you see in spy movies or spy novels. Each individual on the team was picked for his or her expertise, whether it was as a forger or as a master of disguise, or whether it's someone who was excellent at logistics. There are no James Bonds, debonair men in flashy suits. They are ordinary individuals who you would never pick out in a crowd, and that's what made them so good.
For the agents, the mission is personal. Adolf Eichmann is the man who made the Nazis' death trains run on time. He's the man who helped to send millions of Jews from all over occupied Europe to the gas chambers.
Eichmann is called the architect of the Final Solution, and he was very good at his job. A lot of these agents' parents would have been killed essentially at this man's hands. He was a very rabid, intense, fiercely efficient and virulent Nazi. Towards the end of the war, Eichmann tells a fellow Nazi that he will happily go to his grave knowing that he's killed 6 million Jews.
His role was to isolate the Jewish populations, bring them to ghettos, and ultimately ship them to extermination camps like Auschwitz. It was almost like he was operating this factory of death.
He was a specialist on Jews, and he knew quite a lot about them.
He was a desk guy, but he was also in the field. He would go and see the techniques that they were using, gas vans and just shooting Jews. He was out there seeing it.
He's an evil, murdering Nazi bastard. There's no doubt about it.
This was an extremely significant operation for the Mossad. This operation, if they're successful, will put the Mossad on the map.
It was an incredibly ballsy thing for the Israelis to decide, was to show the world that Israel couldn't be messed with. Wherever you are in the world, we will come and get you.
Two weeks after Adolf Eichmann was photographed, an advance team of Mossad agents arrives in Argentina on separate flights on different days.
We all traveled on false passports, on languages we didn't master, in countries we didn't know. And we had nobody to turn to.
The logistic people of the Mossad made our timetable, how to go to the Argentine, hotels to stay, what identification to use.
Their task, confirm the man in the photograph is still at the same address. Surveillance expert Abraham Bendor heads to Garibaldi Street.
I wanted to see the area and the surroundings. So he was driving, I sat near him. By chance, we came when the bus came. And suddenly I saw a man walking and I said to Zvi, that's him in the photo. It's Eichmann, it's Eichmann. Zvi got so excited that he slammed the brakes. It was a lousy car and the brakes were screeching. I said, don't do that, he might get suspicious. When Zvi hit the brakes, I thought that he could never be in my team because he's so nervous. Eichmann, he went on for 150 meters and he turned left. In another 50 minutes, he turned left into the house. That was the only house anyway.
We watched the house of Eichmann for days.
They begin finding out exactly what Eichmann did, what time he woke up, when he left for work, what bus he took, how long he stayed at work, when he came home, what he did when he came home, when the lights finally went out at night.
A single word is telexed back to Mossad headquarters in Israel.
Carrot was the code word that tells you a lot of things. One, we found the man who's in the picture that Zvi brought back. Second, the situation in the field there is possible to make a kidnap operation. Third, we are going to continue the surveillance of the house.
In Jerusalem, the Mossad boss gives the green light to Operation Eichmann. Capture the man who organized the genocide of Europe's Jews and bring him to Israel to stand trial for his crimes.
I was 14 when I left Czechoslovakia. We went to Hungary, and in 1944, we were taken to Auschwitz. All of us, my mother, my sister, my father, my grandfather, my aunt and me, together on the train. We were frightened, we were hungry, we were cold, we were humiliated. We were strictly brought to Auschwitz to be exterminated.
after decimating Poland's Jewish population. In 1944, Eichmann set about sending Hungary's 700,000 Jews to their death.
Ultimately, anybody who is a Hungarian Jew or has their roots in Hungary and is Jewish will have a relative, an ancestor, who was ultimately killed by Adolf Eichmann.
The doors opened, and the first thing before even seeing, we heard the German shepherd barking. And couldn't believe it, that here we were in this horrible, horrible place.
The Mossad chief knows that an extradition request for Adolf Eichmann to Argentina will likely fail. It would also send the Nazi into hiding.
The kidnap team arrives, but they've got lots of things to be getting on with. I mean, it's not just a case of just like hitting him over the head, putting him in a car, putting him in an airplane, let's go home, job done. You've got to work out, if we hold him, where are we going to hold him? So they've got to rent a house. Now, renting a house in 1960 in Argentina is not the easiest thing to just go around doing. There's a lot of things like that which one doesn't think about they had to try and achieve.
That task is given to Master of Disguise Yitzhak Nesher. Posing as a tenant, he finds a villa an hour's drive from Buenos Aires.
They picked this house because the neighbors were not too close. It had an enclosed backyard. It had several rooms big enough to keep all of these agents. It was a normal house in a quiet neighborhood in Buenos Aires. So that was the first factor. The second was they needed to get Eichmann out of the country.
It was Harold who came up with the idea that maybe they would fly Eichmann out with an LL jet.
But Israel's national airline does not fly to Buenos Aires, with one extraordinary exception.
Luckily, and it's one of those bits of coincidence, there's the anniversary of Argentina's founding, and the Israelis say, we want to send a delegation of dignitaries out to come and help celebrate. And Argentina says, yes, well, of course, you must send this special flight. And it's this special flight that's going to take Eichmann out of the country.
So the schedule of when the operation proceeded was based on when that plane was arriving and could take off from Buenos Aires.
The plane is set to arrive on May 12th and depart the next day. This means they have a week to kidnap the war criminal. The clock is ticking.
We saw him every day, the same time, except Sunday. Same bus, same hour, everything the same.
Eichmann is a character of habit. He likes to get off the bus, the 202 bus, at the same time every day, back from this big car factory where he's working.
The road near the house wasn't very busy. There were no people walking on it, and very few driving on it.
Garibaldi Street in 1960 was the worst street in the whole of the Southern Hemisphere to conduct a kidnap. It was completely exposed. The Eichmann house is just this concrete block. It's like putting a dice on a pool table. It's just there, and there's not much else around. So if you're walking along and you look different, you're going to be noticed straight away. It was a strange place to conduct a kidnap, but where else were they going to do it?
So we thought, that's it.
After watching him and his way of doing things, we were convinced that the easiest and the best way to get him was just when he gets out of the bus, walking home.
Now, orchestrating that to come off flawlessly is an entirely different game. The basics of the plan were Eichmann gets off the bus on his way back from work at night. As soon as he turns the corner onto the smaller road leading to his house, they would grab him.
The plan was very machine to walk between the house and the bus. Eichmann walked between the bus and the house, and they should meet somewhere in two-thirds of the way. Zvi Malchin had to tell him, momentito, senor, I would like to ask you a question. That was the plan from the beginning.
to get the mechanism and the tactics together. We did it about 300-400 times.
They practiced throwing Eichmann into the car, putting him down on the floorboard, and driving off.
In 20 seconds, we wanted to do that.
They practiced the route that they would escape from numerous times in case the police were chasing them.
We didn't carry weapons because it was incriminating. Why did we need the weapons for? We don't want to shoot anybody.
We knew that the only enemy that we could face were the Argentine police or the Argentine military. So we said, we don't need any weapons.
And that's a risk we took.
The Mossad agents are running a terrible personal risk in going on this operation. If you were caught in Argentina in 1960 as a known foreign spy, you wouldn't be executed, but you would have been in prison for ages and ages. And of course, your mission probably would have been denied back home, as is the great tradition of most spy stories. So yes, it was a terrible risk.
Since the war, Argentina has offered a safe haven to high-ranking Nazis like Eichmann.
There was a network that Juan Perón, the president of Argentina, put together to bring Nazis to Argentina. It was widely known within the network of underground former Nazis that if they found a way to Argentina, that the Argentinian government would help support them.
With the Allies' victory in 1945, Eichmann became a wanted man and went on the run.
He makes his way up to Hamburg and then ends up in a little town called Everson, where he works as a forester. Then forestry business goes bankrupt, and he finds this old Nazi guide to manage a chicken farm and ends up running what is quite a lucrative chicken business.
But in 1950, fearing capture, Nazi sympathizers in the Catholic Church helped to organize Eichmann's passage to South America from the port of Genoa under the name Ricardo Clement.
The route he's been using is a very well-trodden escape route. Some people call it a rat line. Eichmann's given all the paperwork he needs, such as landing permits for Argentina, exit permits from Italy, and so on and so forth. And eventually, Eichmann sets sail with a third-class ticket to go to a new life in Argentina. Eichmann was certainly not the only senior Nazi to end up going to Argentina. There was almost a great tradition of Nazis going there. Some of them brought some money, some of them brought some technical expertise, and so on and so forth.
The former SS officer has a string of jobs, from running a laundry to raising rabbits. None are a success. He finally finds steady employment in a Mercedes-Benz car plant. While Argentina's military dictatorship welcomed Nazis like Eichmann, it would not take so kindly to a team of Israeli spies on its soil. To outwit the authorities, the agents forge several different license plates for their getaway vehicles.
We had three number plates, and we didn't have these revolving things that they have in James Bond films. We had to put one number plate upon the other, so we didn't lose time in taking off the previous one. That was really better than in movies, much quicker. For each license plate, we had different documents just in case.
In Argentina, in the 50s, the cars you hired weren't the nice sedans we get today. They were pretty ramshackle, and there's always a danger these cars would break down.
The cars were in a terrible condition, all of them, once we had to push them.
Of course, anything would happen.
Operation Eichmann moves into high gear.
From the second Eichmann went underground after the war, he was constantly worried about being found. He was constantly worried about every footstep behind him was someone coming after him. They're constantly fearful that if they let the operation go just one more day, that that day was the one that Eichmann would figure out he was being followed and he would vanish.
There was a danger that he would try to escape and get away from us. Of course, was a danger.
One way or the other, struggle or not, this was the moment to go.
any communication, not communication, not weapons. You could say it was a primitive operation, okay? But sometimes primitive operation works better than others.
May 11th, 1960. The kidnap of Adolf Eichmann is in play.
The Mossad agents arrived in the dark about 30 minutes before Eichmann was to return home from work to get their cars in place. They have two cars, one to capture him, the other to act not only as a backup car, but as an interference car in case they were being pursued by the police.
There are four agents in the front car, and they're the snatch squad. They're gonna grab him. They get out the car, and they have the hood up, and they're tinkering. It's the classic tactic, isn't it, of keeping cover, is playing with your broken car. And they're waiting. Arrives, and they wait for Eichmann to come off the bus. And he's not there. And they just can't believe it.
The only night that he didn't arrive on the 7 o'clock bus was the night we intended to catch him.
People were, how could I say, quite tense.
Every night, Eichmann has been on the same bus. And the night of the kidnap, he's not. And they wait, and they wait, and there's no Eichmann. And after 20 minutes to half an hour, the group are getting very nervous.
Some bicycle went by and asked questions, and some men came by and asked questions. So the people became tensed. Zvi Aharoni asked me, "What do you decide? Maybe we go." I say, "No, we stay."
And you've got to remember Garibaldi Street, this desolate, empty place. They're looking very, very obvious. And then, suddenly, another bus comes. And out of it is the unmistakable little 5'7" figure of the little man walking along, Adolf Eichmann. There can be no doubt about it.
We saw Eichmann coming, and then the operation started.
When he comes with his flashlight, I blind him with my headlights so he doesn't see the other car.
And he's walking towards them. And one of the agents, Malkin, the only Spanish he knows, is the Spanish for a moment, or a little moment.
A momentito, senor. I would like to ask you a question.
You know, trying to get Eichmann over to come and see him. And he says this to Eichmann.
But Eichmann was frightened.
And Eichmann reaches into his pocket, and they think he's got a gun.
And then Malkin jumped on him and took him by his neck instead of his mouth. He tried to hold his hand in his pocket, and therefore Eichmann was free to shout.
He started screaming, and I made a lot of noise with the engine to overshadow this noise.
And at that point, Malkin grabs Eichmann, and they wrestle their way into this ditch.
We jumped on him, legs, belly, head. We put him into the car.
They tell him to shut up, and this is the first order that Eichmann has ever been given by a Jew.
José Tavor immediately went to the front. Zvi Aharoni was already inside the car with the engine running, and I and myself was in the back, his head on my knees, and we covered him with blanket. And then Zvi Aharoni told him in German, "If your life dear to you, be quiet." And then he said,
"You should cooperate with our people, otherwise we're going to kill you." He said, "Ich habe mich schon in mein Schicksal ergeben." That means I have surrendered to my fate.
Eichmann is in the car. I had to lead the way to the safe house.
No one said a word. My hand was on his mouth. He was completely quiet. After 1 mile, we stopped and we changed the plates of the car.
There were Argentinian number plates. We changed them to other Argentinian number plates, which were forged, so there was no suspicion on the cars. We had to change all that in seconds.
Garibaldi Street is a long way from the safe house. And don't forget, they're in a really, really bad Argentine 1960 hire car that can break down at any time. And if it's broken down and a policeman comes to help, it's all over.
We crossed checkpoint by military and police.
The police stopped me and he said nothing and I said nothing.
They saw the foreign plates of the car and they said, go.
It's a nervous drive, but they make it back and they get into the safe house and there they've got him.
We put covered glasses on his face so he couldn't see anyone and couldn't remember anyone.
We didn't speak one syllable, nothing. We didn't talk to him, he didn't talk to us.
We took off his clothes to make sure that he doesn't got any weapon or razor blade to kill himself.
He's given a medical by a doctor who was part of the team to confirm that his heart's okay. It's a very stressful thing to be kidnapped. One thing they have to do, they're 90% sure they've got Eichmann, but they're not 100% sure, and they've got to make sure they're not kidnapping the wrong guy.
Before we went to the Argentine, we studied the SS file that we had in our archive, and we knew Eichmann, his measurements, his facial scars, things like that. And all these helped us to identify him before we talked with him.
One of the agents, Via Haroni, was given the job of interrogating Eichmann in order to establish exactly who he was, what he'd been up to, and so on and so forth.
I asked him, what's your name? And he said, Ricardo Clement. And is that your real true name? And he refused to answer them.
Zwie is a very methodical interrogator. He can drive a person out of his mind when he asks you slowly the same question again and again.
Ricardo Clement. Was that always your name? What was your name before? He said Otto Henninger.
Otto Henninger, that was the name that he used in Germany after the war.
The agents know Eichmann's SS identification number. They find the scar where his telltale SS tattoo should be.
But Eichmann began to burn that off directly after the war ended, because he knew that it was the chief identifier.
So we asked him, did you serve in the SS? He said, yeah. And what was your SS number? He said, the correct number of Eichmann. So you cannot say you're Otto Henninger when you know the correct number of Adolf Eichmann. He's not a genius. He made a mistake.
And Eichmann then knows that the game is up.
Within the space of 10 or 15 minutes, Eichmann admitted that he was Adolf Eichmann.
We were very happy, of course, that we got the right man, because until that moment, we were not really sure. I asked him if he had any role in the Holocaust. How was he involved in it? And he denied, of course, everything. Denied everything.
You would have thought a monster like Eichmann would have a much more impressive physical presence, but it's just this sort of pathetic little man. Yet he was the one who had organized this enormous murder.
Hey, trains. Then when I hear that sound, I'm immediately transported back to 1944 and the trip to Auschwitz. We had to jump off the train, and then we saw the soldier there, and we saw the people standing on line, and one went to the left, one went to the right. We went to the right, and the elderly, they went immediately to the gas chambers. I didn't see my grandmother anymore. I never saw her actually leaving. mercifully. And they purposely over-separated families. My aunt and me on one side, my sister and mother on the other, and it's the last time that I had seen them.
The mission has gone like clockwork, until now. Argentine officials delay the special Israeli plane that will take Eichmann out of the country.
The team have a real problem now. They're stuck in this house with this figure of evil, thousands of miles away from home, with some very hot property. And that is not a good situation to be in.
The Mossad agents holding Adolf Eichmann have hit a serious problem.
They thought they were going to be there in the safe house for 2 or 3 days. In fact, the special El Al flight was going to be delayed by up to a week.
We knew that the flight would come to the Argentine something between 20 and 21st of May.
And there's not much they can do until their means of escape, this El Al jet, will be able to take them back across the Atlantic. They're stuck in the safe house. And like any people living close together under times of great stress, a lot of members of the team are, you know, having goes at each other.
They were constantly worried in the safe house about people coming after them, whether the police or Eichmann's friends, and most importantly, his family.
His family are running around trying to find him with various friends of theirs sympathetic to the Nazis.
The risks were definitely the German community of Buenos Aires. The less happens, the more you get worried. Rafi was in charge, had the most of the burden on him. He thought that it's impossible that the Nazis don't look for him or the family. He was really, really, really worried.
They've got this very tense time. And what's not helped is they don't want to let Eichmann out of their sight, or he might commit suicide or try and escape. These agents, and this is what's really unpleasant, they even have to help him go to the lavatory, and I mean help him do everything. It's quite something to clean someone off when you know that that man has murdered 6 million of your people.
It would have been much simpler to just kill Eichmann, but they needed to bring him back to trial.
All the people in the house, though some of them were Holocaust survivors, all of them knew the importance of bringing Eichmann alive to Israel, all of them. They knew it, they understood it, and they fully agreed with it.
The agents insist Eichmann sign a statement that he is returning to Israel of his own free will. If caught by Argentinian authorities, it might be the only thing that can save them.
Eichmann tried to get them saying, I'm a German citizen, I should be tried in Germany. But they told him, you're coming to Israel. And ultimately, they got him to sign it.
He gave me a letter signed by himself. I have the letter here. He said, I, Adolf Eichmann, the one who has signed this letter, I hereby declare ready to go to Israel in order to clear my conscience.
He said he understood what his fate will be, and he was facing his fate.
8 days after Eichmann was kidnapped, the specially chartered El Al plane finally lands in Buenos Aires. 24 hours later, the final and most dangerous phase of the mission begins.
The way of getting Eichmann out of the country on this El Al plane is spectacularly brilliant. They decide they're going to disguise Eichmann as a flight attendant.
We had a doctor with us who looked after him, and we gave him an injection.
And they're going to make out that he's drunk. They leave the safe house. They eventually arrive at the airport. They drive through the sort of special area where the crew are allowed to go. And there is this slightly comatose Eichmann.
They took him out and carried him on the stairs into the plane in uniform. And we waited to get the all clear for takeoff.
The diplomatic crew that had come to Argentina had disembarked. The only passenger going back to Israel, besides the crew and the Mossad, was Adolf Eichmann. They told the crew an hour before they were about to take off they were escorting Adolf Eichmann out of the country.
The agents travel under the guise of Israeli diplomats and off-duty LL crew.
Even when they got Eichmann onto the plane and they sit him in a first-class seat, they still weren't home and dry. Argentine immigration authorities turn up onto the plane, as they're entitled to do. They want to check passports. And they walk up and down the plane checking passports. And there's a passport for Eichmann in a fake name, clearly. What's wrong with him? Oh, he's drunk. Too much partying, you know what it's like, Buenos Aires, you know, too much of going to dances and girls. And of course, the Argentine guy just thinks that's perfectly normal. This won't be the first drunken flight attendant he's seen. They get off, the steps are taken away from the plane.
They're prepared to take off. They're taxiing to the runway. When suddenly air traffic control says, stop. You can't go anywhere. Now you can imagine this moment where they have Eichmann, they're ready to go, and now what's wrong?
Moments before takeoff, the plane carrying Adolf Eichmann to Israel is grounded.
They said 5 minutes and then 10 minutes and 20 minutes, but we were suspicious of everything. We were also tense.
Have the authorities been alerted that Eichmann is on board? Is this operation about to unravel? Israel wants to take off and risk the prowess of the Argentinian Air Force. And an individual named Shaul Shaul, who is the navigator of the plane, says, I will go. I will check out and see what's wrong. So this normal navigator is told by Israel, if you're not back in 10 minutes, we're taking off without you. And he steps off the plane, his heart sinking into his shoes, thinking, I may never come back. It turns out that they had not filed something in the flight plan. The navigator gets back on the plane, then they take off.
Well, of course, it was a great relief and satisfaction then we finally took off and went up in the air with Eichmann in the plane.
The pilot announces that the plane has left Argentinian airspace.
It was actually almost a celebration that they had accomplished this.
But they still weren't home and dry. Normally, in those days, you would fly north up to Brazil from Buenos Aires, refuel at Recife, make your way across the Atlantic to Dakar in Africa, where you would then refuel and head on to Israel. Now, of course, the Israelis did not want to stay in South America at all in case someone was onto them. So they had to try and get this plane across the Atlantic all the way to Dakar on a single tank of fuel. And it was touch and go. They're almost flying on vapor when they land.
When it was announced that Adolf Eichmann had been captured, the world was absolutely stunned. For the Israeli secret services to capture an individual 9,000 miles away and do it all secretly and quietly was extraordinary.
The Eichmann trial was, in many ways, more than iconic. It, in fact, put the Holocaust on the cultural map.
It reminded the world of what had happened in the Holocaust and launched this whole investigation of the Jewish experience during the war. Without the trial, people may have swept the Holocaust under the rug.
A lot of very, very powerful testimony was made during the trial of those who had either met Eichmann or survived the camps, and the extent and the savagery of what had happened was incredibly heartrending. Eichmann's defense was the tired, time-stained, boring, I was following orders defense. Eichmann's found guilty, which will come as no surprise, and he's going to be executed.
When I heard that Adolf Eichmann was finally captured and being brought to justice, I was, of course, very glad that finally he gets repaid for what he has done.
It was difficult to understand how such a man, who doesn't look like a big personality, was responsible for the death of millions of people. I don't know the answer.
The night before he's to be hanged, he writes letters to his family, and he declares how much he loves Germany, and everything I just did for my fatherland. And he's then taken out of his cell, and he's hanged quickly, efficiently. He's then cremated straight away. And his ashes are put in a bucket, and the bucket's put on a boat, and the boat sails off the Israeli coast, out of Israeli waters. They don't want to be touched by the ashes of this man. And they tip the ashes into the water, and there are a few ashes left in the bucket. And they rinse them out. They want to get every last grain of Eichmann out, and they rinse out the bucket, and they go back home.
The end was just.